Welcome to Conversations Live. For more than a decade, we've brought you the best in books, entertainment, celebrity interviews, and current events. When the movers and shakers of the world have something to say to you, they say it to us first. Here's your host, Cyrus Webb.
Welcome back, everyone, to Conversations Live. I'm your host, Cyrus Webb. Glad you all could join us once again. For our radio audience tuning in at WYAD 94.1 FM and WYADonline.com, we're glad you all could be with us. Also, tuning in to our online affiliates, thanks for our podcast. We're glad you all could be with us as well. If you've been watching what's happening in the world, especially in the United States, and even watching the news or reading on the Internet, you know the Supreme Court has been in the news a whole lot, and not everyone has been agreeing with the decisions that they've been making, even though they're impacting the lives of all of us. One of the big ways that has been really showing itself is when it comes to the issue of voting rights. Well, our next guest is back to talk about his brand new book, The Road of the Courts, and what you need to know about voting rights and what's happening around us. We're excited to welcome back law professor and author Joshua A. Douglas to our broadcast today. His new book is called The Court Versus the Voters, the troubling story of how the Supreme Court has undermined voting rights. We'll talk to him about what led him to write this book, but also what he's been able to see when it comes to some of the rulings and the impact it has on all of us today. If you're just now finding out about the new book, we'll let you know how to get your own copy of it and stay connected with Joshua as well. But Joshua, thanks again for the time. Really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me, Cyrus. Great to be back.
The pleasure is definitely all mine. So I was saying to you before we went live here, we had a great conversation about your book, Vote for Us. And I think there's so much you've been able to do when it comes to the issue. Of course, this is definitely your wheelhouse, getting us to better understand and appreciate not only, of course, the role of the Supreme Court, but also how it does impact us. And I think especially if you look at the past few years, I think people are really realizing that more. I want to start there, Joshua. What has it been like for you to be a part of that conversation of the consequences that can come from the rulings from the Supreme Court and how it does impact our everyday lives?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I often half joke that what's bad for the country is good for me professionally, and things have been way too good recently. These issues are so important because they impact all of us. They impact democracy, and so that's why I've focused my work as a law professor in writing for the general public. You know, everyday voters are the lifeblood of our democracy. And the question I get a lot is, you know, oh, this book is by a law professor. Is it going to be understandable? And I wrote it specifically for non-lawyers. I have lots of stories in the book. I tell a ton of interesting stories about the important players in Supreme Court decisions to help people understand just the huge impact that the court has on our democracy.
Judge, well, that's such a great point. I was actually going to bring that up myself for our audience, because when I have these type of guests on the show, I get asked that question all the time. Am I going to be able to understand this? You know, I think a lot of people realize the importance of it, but also I think this is part of the problem, Joshua, I think. And I love the way that you wrote this book, and shout out to Beacon Press for another great book that allows the public to really be able to understand the everyday impact here, because this book is understandable. I think that's going to make people more prone to read it and then, of course, to discuss it and hopefully realize the importance for change. Is that kind of your hope in doing this and doing all this research, being able to share these different court cases and rulings to get people to realize, you know what, gone are the days when we say, well, that doesn't impact me. We realize now that everything impacts us.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, as I said, democracy belongs to all of us. And so, you know, we all need to take a role, an active role in protecting it, especially this year with all the various threats that we're seeing to democratic institutions. We can't sit on the sidelines. You know, there are forces that are trying to take away easy voting access. Obviously, we have a long, sorry history of discrimination on the basis of race in voting and lots of other areas of our society, but you know, voting is such an important aspect of that, and we can't sit on the sidelines. You know, the old saying, it's not mine, but democracy is not a spectator sport. We have to get involved, and so my hope in writing this book is to inform people, educate people about the role of the Supreme Court, to entertain, like, as we just discussed. I tell a lot of interesting stories, but but also then to create a call for action for people to recognize that there is a way to for everyday Americans to help protect democracy, but we have to, you know, have the knowledge to do so and then understand what it is we can do to have an important voice.
I want to talk about two aspects of this, Joshua, in this conversation. One, when it comes to the issue of voter ID for our radio audience here in Mississippi, we know, of course, that's been a topic that's come up, but also felon disenfranchisement, something that you also write a bit. I'm going to begin with voter ID because it is one of those things that I think as people have had these conversations, Joshua, and you know this more so than myself, people say, well, you know what, it's a good idea, you know, for us to be able to have these laws in place. It's a good idea to prevent fraud. And yet you bring up in the book something that's very interesting, and you go back, of course, to, you know, looking at different periods. And one thing you reference in the chapter, the fight over voter ID, is that when it was studied, elections between 2000 and 2014, when they were looking at in-person voter fraud, you say this: can you guess how many incidents that were found? 31 out of over 1 billion ballots cast. Over those 14 years, there were only 31 credible allegations of in-person impersonation in all general, primary, special, and municipal elections. Did that surprise you, Joshua, as you were doing this research, or did you have an idea already in writing the book that this was something that was not as big of a deal as some have tried to make it out to be?
Yeah, that didn't surprise me at all. And that study was done by a friend of mine, a fellow law professor, Justin Levitt, who, yeah, he looked at every election in those years and found only 31 even potential instances of in-person impersonation. And actually about half of those were even innocuous things like a father and son with the same name, senior and junior, and the poll worker checking off the wrong one. You know, but the problem here is that we're in a situation or a society where if you say something enough times, people start to believe it. And so we keep hearing the mantra of voter fraud, voter fraud. But when you look, it just doesn't exist. And especially, you know, the kind of fraud that an ID law would prevent, you know, in-person impersonation, someone showing up to the polls and pretending they're someone they're not. It's basically non-existent. But how do you prove a negative? It's like when my kids were younger and, you know, they would say, Daddy, there's a monster under the bed. And no matter how many times I would look, you know, there's no monster there. It's hard to prove to them. But, of course, I didn't set booby traps in their room to catch the monsters because that would harm them, right? And so we have to think about what is the harm we're, you know, leading towards? What is the harm we're imposing when we try to take these measures? I mean, of course, we should have elections that are free of fraud. I don't think anyone would disagree with that premise, but at what expense are we going to chase the fraud that doesn't exist and harm voters in the process?
Yeah, and Joshua, that is why in this show is an apolitical show. We don't really get into trying to take one side or the other. But one thing I think that it is a reasonable thing that you talk about in that chapter is that the difference in, as you were just saying with your children, is there is the reality and there is what is said and what is believed. I mean, as you talk about in that chapter, you have former President Trump that talked about this widespread voter fraud, and yet we also have his Attorney General Bill Barr saying there was no widespread election fraud, and yet, even though that is his job to be able to find that, people still believe what the former president said over what Bill Barr had to say. Talk to us about the louder voices, because I think that's a bigger point of this book, actually, too, is that a lot of times if you say something enough, if you're a person who is convincing enough, you can get people to pretty much go along with whatever you want. What was that like for you to look at as you were looking at these different issues, whether we're talking about voter ID or even what's happening when it comes to felons and voting?
Yeah, it's frustrating to have the facts and to try to disseminate the facts, and you have these louder voices that don't have the evidence. And it's understandable that people maybe don't know what or who to believe. You know, on the issue you mentioned of felon disenfranchisement, you have you know, it's nice to see a bipartisan push in some places to eliminate these laws. But what you see them, you know, looking at the facts and the history, is that they are a mechanism to harm people of color in particular, to take away the right to vote for life. And you see, like in Florida, where the voters themselves kind of, you know, rose up and fought for a state constitutional amendment to reenfranchise 1.4 million returning citizens, and then the state legislature turns around and tries to limit that, tries to narrowly construe the expansion of voting rights. So our history is one of constant push and pull between expanding access to the ballot and making it harder for some people to vote. And so I sometimes, you know, you ask, like, so what is it like for me to hear all of this misinformation? I try to go back to first principles. What is our democracy supposed to be about? What does the Declaration of Independence say? It says that a government is not legitimate except for based on the consent of the governed. Shouldn't the governed be all of us? And how is that a controversial topic, a controversial question in terms of literally who should be allowed to vote and contribute to the legitimacy of our government?
Yeah, I think that is and again, this conversation, even though it was you and I had this conversation on the books before this week, here in my home state of Mississippi, where we're on the radio dial, Joshua, I don't know if you heard about this or not, just this week, our governor vetoed 4 felony voting restoration bills. But they did sign 2 into law for the first time that were what they were calling suffrage restoration bills. And it really does go to show the timeliness of this, but also, of course, as a lot of people know, unless you've been living under a rock, this is a presidential election year as well. And that leads us back to the point you were just making about the felon restoration, because I want to stay with that for a second, Joshua, because I found it interesting the way that you wrote that, again, in a very simple way for our audience to understand. You say this: voting is a fundamental right. It's backwards to read the Constitution, as you were just alluding to, our founding document, as allowing states to take away that fundamental right. Democracy has not broken in D.C., Maine, or Vermont, where currently incarcerated individuals can vote from jail via absentee ballot. Of course, continued felon disenfranchisement has both political and racial ramifications. You were just alluding to that, Joshua, which is a primary reason it has endured. So much of this does seem to come back to race and bias. And I think it goes to an interesting issue here, Joshua, at a time when there are some who will say, well, that is not a problem this country has. What has that been like for you to grapple with in conversation about the issue of some things are very obvious, you know, what is the reason behind it, and yet not so obvious for people to admit to?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the history of voting rights is intimately intertwined with the racial struggles of our country. And as someone who does not identify as a minority, I think it's even more important for me to be sensitive to these issues and to recognize the struggle that so many people have had in trying to effectuate the right to vote, you know, just to have a say in our democracy. And so you see these measures like felon disenfranchisement or even voter ID laws, and you look at the numbers, that there's the people who are affected, and you see how it's a disproportionate effect on people of color. And you start to think, you know, what's the motivation here? What's actually behind these types of measures? You know, with respect to felon disenfranchisement, I think you can say to people, look, you know, who here wants to be judged by the worst mistake they ever made? No one, right? And yet you have these arguments that, well, you know, they've broken the social contract. But if you look at the history of felon disenfranchisement, you see the expansion to certain felonies that, you know, states would make certain things felonies that minority individuals would be convicted of more often. And you see how this is all wrapped up in a struggle for political power as well. And so the race and politics aspect are also intertwined. You can't separate them. You know, it's what's been referred to now as second generation barriers to the ballot. No longer, thankfully, are we making people, you know, only black people do things like tell me how many bubbles there are in a bar of soap to be able to register. You know, that was just overt racism. Now it's I guess more subtle, right? It's what's called second generation barriers, things that, you know, on their face seem like, well, they're neutral, they're not targeted toward race. But when you dive into the numbers, you see, oh, wait, this is another underhanded way of harming minority individuals as part of a racial struggle, as a part of a political struggle.
Such a great point and so important. I want to say for those who are just tuning in, welcome. You're listening to Conversations Live here on the radio side here in Mississippi at WYAD 94.1 FM and WYADonline.com. We also welcome those tuning in online worldwide via our podcast. If you all did come in late, don't worry. The podcast will be available after my chat with my guest. We're speaking with law professor and author Joshua A. Douglas. His newest book is called The Court Versus the Voters, The Troubling Story of How the Supreme Court Has Undermined Voting Rights. So the last thing I want to talk to you about, Joshua, and again, appreciate this time with you. Is it a term we probably have heard thrown around? I'm also the news director here, Joshua, for our station in Mississippi, so we've been talking about this term, and that is about an activist court. You literally have a chapter that talks about this, and one of the people spotlighted in the chapter, someone, once again, you couldn't have planned this any better, I guess, maybe, say, or not, I don't know. Alito, who is featured prominently in this chapter, is in the news this week, and not for good reasons for either. I guess we could say that.
Yeah.
Talk to us about that, because, here it is. Joshua, I'm an optimistic person. I am a person who tries to see the good in individuals. I'm not a person who tries to question individuals' motives. However, even with that being said, some things are very obvious. Some things are, you know, you look at things and you say, okay, well, I could give this person some grace with this, but with this, it's very obvious there's something else going on here. What was that like for you to look at the court, to a court I know you respect, but also to look at them critically and look at decisions?
Yeah, and so this involves a particular case I talk about in the book called Brnovich versus Democratic National Committee, a case that decided in 2021 about two provisions of Arizona law that made it harder for people to return their ballots, or also if they showed up at the wrong polling place and cast a ballot, their ballot would not count. And the plaintiffs had evidence that the law had a disproportionate impact on minority voters, Native American voters, Latino voters, black voters, et cetera. I mean, there was evidence there. It wasn't a huge difference, but it did show that minority voters would be harmed more by these laws. So the plaintiffs bring suit under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, one of the most important civil rights statutes ever passed. And it gets all the way to the Supreme Court. And as I write in the chapter, I write in the book, Justice Alito made up the law. And I don't make that kind of a statement lightly because, you hear this idea of activist judges. Well, what's an activist judge? Some people say, well, it's just a judge who rules in a way that I disagree with. I don't think that's the right definition. I mean, judges are going to rule in ways that you might not like. To me, an activist judge is someone who's actually putting their own personal views into the law. And that's exactly what Alito did here. So he's talking about this provision of the Voting Rights Act, a super important mechanism to try to achieve greater equality in our voting rules and root out discrimination. And he says, well, if a plaintiff wants to invoke this provision, this Section 2 argument to get a law struck down, I think the plaintiff should have to satisfy these five guideposts, he calls them, five things that plaintiffs should have to demonstrate to be able to have a successful case under Section 2. These are things that never existed before. They're not in the law. They're not in the legislative history. You know, Congress never said anything about any of these five guideposts. And all five of them make it harder for plaintiffs to make their case. There are things like, you know, is the law one that existed back in 1982 when Congress amended the statute? So it's been around for a long time. Well, that's not part of the inquiry. That if a law is harming minority voters, it shouldn't matter if it's been doing it for 20-something years or 40-something years, if it's having an effect today. So Alito created these five guideposts. He has virtually no citations in the opinion to them. He doesn't, you know, point to legal authority to support them. I guess he came up with them almost out of thin air, and every single one of them makes it harder to for voters to bring their case. And this is just an example of the trend where the majority here in of the court is gutting the Voting Rights Act systematically, making it harder for plaintiffs to bring their case without overturning it entirely. So, you know, they're trying to be incremental. They're hiding behind this idea that, oh, we're not moving things so much, but little by little it's chipping away at a law that has been so consequential for trying to make voting fairer and more equal.
What was the biggest surprise for you, Joshua? This is a world, again, that you live in, you're immersed in. But what was the biggest surprise for you when you looked at some of these rulings and decisions and it came to the impact?
I think the biggest surprise is that there were decisions that the court rendered in the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s that people have never heard of, but that have had an outsized impact on today's underprotection of the right to vote. I think a lot of people recognize the Supreme Court has been negative on rights in the past 10 years, or maybe people even point to Bush v. Gore, which ended the 2000 presidential election. But I discussed some cases that laid the foundation, especially in the 1980s and 1990s, that led to what the court has done today. And I think when those decisions were issued, no one really recognized the impact they would have on the right to vote, the impact they would have in the court failing to protect the constitutional right to vote. It's only when we look back and we see how these cases are intertwined can we fully understand the story of what's happened to voting rights at the Supreme Court. So I think that's the thing that is perhaps the most surprising and one of the biggest takeaways here is that it's not just a recent phenomenon and that we should be paying closer attention to some of the decisions that the court issues because they can blossom into much worse rules later on, sort of pseudo-incrementally, and the court would like to think it's being incremental instead of, you know, a major decision that just reverses everything. And the court does that sometimes too, like it did in the Roe v. Wade abortion context. But with voting rights, the court is trying not to look like it's rendering decisions that are so harmful, but it, collectively and over, you know, recent history, you see that they are.
Such a great point and such a great conversation, Joshua. I'm so glad we got a chance to talk again. I really appreciate the way that you write, the way that you're able to help us to understand and comprehend things that are not always easy, and I think that's, again, part of the problem. Is that people we hear things, but we don't really get a chance to really understand it and to grasp the impact on us. And your writing definitely does that. Again, the newest book is The Court Versus the Voters, The Troubling Story of How the Supreme Court Has Undermined Voting Rights. As I mentioned earlier, it is published by Beacon Press. You can get it through our friends at Amazon.com, or you can go to Beacon Press website as well, which is beacon.org. And Joshua, you have a website as well. Let our audience know. How can they stay connected with you?
Yeah, well, first, let me just thank you again for the kind words about the way I wrote the book. I worked really hard to make it accessible for non-voters because I think that is so important. You can find me at joshuaadouglas.com. Again, joshuaadouglas.com. I've got all of my writing up there. I do a lot of writing in the popular press for newspapers and other media outlets. I started my own podcast this year called Democracy Optimist, so you can find that on there as well as information about my book. So joshuaadouglas.com.
All right, and we should let our audience know, because I'm also a top Amazon reviewer, that Joshua's book is a number one new release on Amazon, so congratulations on that, Joshua. I'm not surprised. Again, it is a book that is so important, and I think the message cannot be more timely, and definitely looking forward to chatting with you again.
Thanks so much. It was great to be on.
Hey, the pleasure is definitely all ours, and we thank your audience for tuning in to another great segment of Conversations Live. Until next time, I'm your host, Cyrus Webb, saying, as always, enjoy your day, enjoy your life, enjoy your world. Thank you all for choosing Conversations Live, and let's go make today amazing. Take care.